Hello once again, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on this Wednesday, February 12th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so. We're going to go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to be with me here as we push our way through the middle of the week. Two guests join me on today's program. The first, professional handicapper Brian Leonard from WagerTalk.com. We'll talk some Major League Baseball and we'll talk some NBA here with what is essentially the last day before the All-Star break. For most of the league, there are a couple of games on Thursday. We'll chat about tonight's card. We'll chat about the approach. Then also talk about some cautionary tales during the NBA All-Star break. Second half of today's show, Wes Reynolds will join me at Wes Reynolds in the number one on Twitter, regular contributor to VSiN and the Point Spread Weekly Newsletter. We'll talk XFL with him as week two coming up here beginning on Saturday. We'll talk some Big Ten college basketball and talk this week's golf tournament, the Genesis Invitational, out at Riviera Country Club. Over at bangthebook.com, we are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. James Mazzola has a preview up for us of that Genesis Invitational. We've got daily NBA, NHL, and college basketball stuff. I wrote up a UFC Fight Night preview for this weekend's card in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. We've got Noops' NBA power ratings. We've got John Ryan's breakdowns of the Big East and the Big Ten for this week in college basketball. Very, very busy over at bangthebook.com. Make sure you head on over there and check it all out. And hopefully by this time next week, I'll start posting some of my Major League Baseball stuff with my season win total write-ups, futures things for divisions, World Series, pennants, individual player futures, all that good stuff coming up here very, very soon over at the website. Finally, as you know, this and every edition of Bang the Book Radio presented by our friends over at DSI Sportsbook. BTB and the number 200 is that promo code. 100% deposit match bonus for the sportsbook, 100% deposit match bonus for the live casino at BetDSI. It's only a game until you bet it. Two guests on the program here today. We start with professional handicapper Brian Leonard from WagerTalk.com. Brian, how's it going today, man?
Hey, everything's going great. Looking forward to talk some baseball, some NBA, and hopefully get the listeners some winners.
Yes, definitely. That's the plan here on today's show. And, hey, man, spring training underway. Pitchers and catchers reporting. We're finally getting close to the start of the Major League Baseball season. Before we talk about that a little bit, though, spring training, what are you kind of looking for here, you know, whether it's the early days or kind of as we start getting some full team workouts?
Yeah, it's interesting. I usually go to spring training, spend a week or two there. I like to go early when we get to see some of the minor leaguers that the teams are taking a look at. It's easier to get tickets for those games. They're not as crowded. As you get closer to the regular season, obviously the teams are playing starters a little bit longer. And that's when you see a lot of people at the games, a lot of sellouts. Certain places you can't even get tickets unless you buy them ahead of time. I'm not big in the crowd, so I look at it. I could see these players play, you know, during the regular season, obviously with the MLB package. So I enjoy being able to see the guys that have been talked about in the Arizona Fall League. I remember when Lindor was the big prospect for Cleveland, getting a chance to watch him play early in the spring and just see how fluid he was. And you could tell he was a great athlete and just getting a little bit of a heads up. And usually when you're at the earlier spring training games, you've got guys there that, you know, the scouts are there to see the younger players, and you could sit there and talk to the scouts and get their opinions. Everybody's pretty open on what they think of some of these players, and it's a learning experience. So to me, if you're going to spring training, at least from a betting standpoint, I'd prefer to go early and learn about the younger players. And as we know, even though these teams got a 40-man roster, it changes all the time, and the teams that start, players that start the year on the team don't necessarily become the regulars, and we see that all the time in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, I think one of the more important things that I kind of take a look at here in spring training is, you know, again, and not everybody's in a baseball mindset as of yet, but, you know, I mean, a lot of my Twitter timeline, baseball writers, baseball follows, stuff like that. I'm always looking for injuries because people don't necessarily think of the impact of spring training injuries. And I'll give you an example of one here that I saw earlier today, Cole Hamels. The Atlanta Braves signed Cole Hamels to give themselves, you know, a little bit more depth, a little bit more of a proven guy out there in the starting rotation. And he's already dealing with shoulder discomfort. And Cole Hamels is a guy that really has pitched through a lot of shoulder discomfort throughout his career. He's been very good overall, but he is getting older now. And those nagging injuries tend to be a little bit worse, as I'm sure you know, as I'm finding out here as I get deeper into my 30s. But for Cole Hamels, they're going to reevaluate him in 3 weeks. So some left shoulder discomfort. In 3 weeks, they're going to take another look, kind of figure some things out. So he'll do what he can, but keep in mind here that with these spring training injuries, they hurt your ability to ramp up to the start of the season. So even if you are ready to go on opening day, you're probably going to start slow. And I always mentioned this early on in the regular season too. You know, invariably there will be a guy that hurts an oblique in mid-April, something like that, misses 6 weeks and comes back. Well, he still wasn't built up to the start of the season at 100%. When he gets back, he has to do that again. So it's almost like an extra 3 or 4 weeks that you add on to that injury. So pay very close attention here to these injuries in spring training, because these could have long-ranging impacts for these players and these teams.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, even though the games are being played in Arizona and in Florida, it's not always warm weather at those sites early in the spring, especially now. So you get a veteran, as you mentioned, that has had problems in the past. You could see something like that happen. One of the things I like to look at is follow the pitch counts. And a lot of people don't pay any attention to what happened to spring training other than what the actual numbers are, which to me are a complete waste, because people are out there just, you know, you may see a starter saying, I'm just going to go out there and throw fastballs all day today. And then the other team racks them up for 10 runs and 4 innings of work. And you go, oh, he was terrible. Well, if the other team knows all he's getting is fastballs, they're going to be able to tee off. But for him, he wants to get that and build up his fastball count. And, you know, certain guys are used to pitching a certain amount. And as you said, when you get set back again to the starting point, you've got to build it up again. So normally, you know, you like to have guys that are at least at 75 that can go out in the first week and throw 70, 75 pitches and build up to 100 and 110 as the season goes on. But if you get set back and, you know, you're a guy like that, then you're only at 30, 40 pitches at that point. Unless you're following it, you really don't know. And people will just, you know, opening week, you know, you get excited and you go, oh, this guy was great last year and he, you know, he's pitching tonight. And you just assume it's the same guy as the year before, but it's really not, because he's not in that same area as he was the previous season.
Yeah. And again, I mean, these are things that you want to pay close attention to, obviously a lot more with pitchers than you do hitters, because, you know, hitters generally have that quicker recovery time because they don't have to build their arm strength up the way that pitchers do. But again, something like this with Cole Hamels, I mean, yeah, you sit there and say, okay, he gets reevaluated in 3 weeks. Well, that's maybe, you know, the second or, you know, 2.5 weeks or something like that into spring training games. Yeah, but that's a lot of time of building up his arm, bullpen sessions, things of that sort that he winds up missing. He's probably going to miss at least the first half of April, if not all of April here, assuming it's just a minor thing. All of a sudden that changes kind of the outlook for the Twins or for the Braves, who do have great starting pitching depth. Don't get me wrong. They're one of the deepest rotations and minor league systems in baseball, but still, Hamels was a guy you thought you'd have out there for 180 respectable innings. He would be in that mentorship role to guys like Max Fried and Mike Soroka, stuff like that. He can still do that, but now he may not be out there at the start of the season in April. Again, keep in mind here too that, you know, these win totals are 6-month investments, and you want to look at the ceiling and the floor for these teams, the upgrades, the downgrades, stuff like that. Maybe missing 4 or 5 Hamels starts isn't a big deal, but we will get injuries where pitchers will miss 10, 12, 14 starts on teams that don't have a lot of depth. All of a sudden, that really changes their outlook.
Yeah, take a look at the New York Yankees. I mean, one of their key starters is going to be gone for 3 months, I believe. So coming into the, you know, the spring and everything, they were thinking they were in pretty good shape. That was probably the weakness on the team last year, because their ace wasn't in the lineup early this season. He came in later in the year. So the best laid plans, as they say. You know, we saw with our hometown Indians last year, we had a lot of injuries for the starting pitchers. It's part of the game. And that's why you have to pay attention to the minor leaguers and the guys that are on the verge of making the pros. And if teams have the wherewithal to bring in somebody, if they get somebody that's hurt early in the season. And to me, that's a major concern when you're playing your season wins, is will this team make an adjustment and bring somebody else in? Or are they just going to say, well, we're playing it out this year, and we may not necessarily be tanking, but we're not good enough to make the playoffs, which is brings up the whole situation that Major League Baseball trying to change a playoff format. I was speaking to a couple guys I respect yesterday about it, and it's interesting. It'll be at a point where a team will, instead of having to play that one game, is it worth making all these moves to get one game shot to make the playoffs? Well, now you may be able to play three games, even though you're probably going to be on the road. I would rather take three games on the road as opposed to one game, which could be played anywhere. So, yeah, it'll be an interesting season. And, you know, they made some changes with the DL. You know, they've tried a 10-day, a 15-day, that kind of thing. So you got to be up on all this and be able to understand certain teams will put people on the DL, which would leave them out for the 15 days. Or there's other teams that try to shorten their bench by keeping them in the lineup in case he comes back early. A lot of that has to do with the guys coming up. And, you know, Cleveland, being that we're fans of the Indians, they've been able to bring these guys that we never even heard of the last 3 or 4 years. And all of a sudden, these guys are now coming in and they're expected to be in the starting rotation.
So what you're referring to there is that Major League Baseball may be expanding to 7 playoff teams in each league and then kind of going with a 3-game series. There are buys involved for the top teams. There are ideas to maybe pick your opponent for the first round. We'll see if that comes to fruition a little bit down the line here. But for now, we've got our regular format, the 3 division winners, the wild card game. The winner of the wild card game goes on to play the team with the best record. So as we take a look ahead here, do some futures stuff, whether it's division, pennant, or World Series, do you generally see any value betting? You know, obviously you and I both see value in the season win totals, but do you see value in betting on these World Series or division or pennant futures?
Yeah, the only time I do is if I see something that I think is drastic. I played the Padres 30-1 when they lost to the Yankees in the World Series, but like I said, it's something that's got to be like a long shot type of thing to be able, you know, there's people out there right now going in and playing the LA Dodgers to win the World Series at this current number, which is very short. To me, to tie up your money for 6-7 months for this kind of thing on something that's very similar to what you could probably get when the playoffs start is something that I'm not interested in doing. There's a young team, you know, we got certain teams in baseball that have some young talent. They may be able to put it all together and really surprise. If you're getting 30-40-1, something like that, I may be interested in doing it. But for the most part, I look for the over-unders for season wins.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, because you look at the sample size of a Major League Baseball season, over 162 games, you're not getting a ton of surprises. You know, over a 16-game NFL season, it's very much possible. Or in the NHL, where there's just, you know, a lot of parity league-wide, there are some good opportunities out there, I think. In the NBA, obviously, we know how top-heavy it's been of late. Maybe this year, the East a little bit more wide open, I guess you could say, if you're not a believer in Milwaukee. I mean, at this point, I don't know why you wouldn't be. I think the NBA and Major League Baseball have the least amount of value in terms of betting playoff-related futures. I think win totals are absolutely worth it. I think they're a great way to get some futures money out there. But Major League Baseball, I mean, it's very top-heavy right now. You know it. I know it. Everybody knows it. Like you said, unless you find some really balloon number, it's hard to do. I just don't think it's worth tying your money up for a long stretch of time to play a 4-1 or a 6-1 or a 7-1, something like that. Maybe if you find a 25 or a 30, like you referenced, or I know some places out there have our Indians at 40-1. Maybe there's some equity in that. But by and large, I just don't think it's a good market to dive into.
Yeah. NBA, there's probably 3-4 teams that can win the championship. In the NFL in a given year, maybe 6. Major League Baseball, just a few years ago, the Kansas City Royals came out of nowhere and won it. Baseball is different. We see it every once in a while. How many years have the Yankees and the Dodgers been the highest payrolls and not win it? It's hockey, to me, is the one where you find a team with a hot goalie and they go right through the playoffs. Hockey, to me, is if you're looking to play a futures to win it all, that would be the sport that I would recommend, because you just watch these hockey games and a team could be dominating. In fact, the other day, I think Detroit was at Boston, and Detroit wins at Boston. And Detroit's by far the worst team, and I think Boston's probably the best along with Tampa. And, you know, they're like a $4 favorite, and they lose straight up. You see that in baseball. You don't see that in the NFL very often, other than the big surprise to me was the final week of the season when Miami wins, is what, the 17-point underdog at New England. You don't see that kind of thing very often, especially in the NBA playoffs where you've got so many up and down the court. But anytime you have a tennis or an NBA where you've got more reps, you're going to see the better teams win. And which is why, you know, in baseball, we play 162 games. That's why I love baseball. At the end of the season, the guys, teams making the playoffs are all pretty good.
Yeah, at least you would certainly hope so. I mean, for the most part, they definitely have been here of late. So with kind of that division mindset in mind here, I thought this was a pretty good line. I'm not an odds maker by any means, but I guess this is a pretty good line here. 6 division winners last year. Yankees, Twins, Astros, Braves, Cardinals, Dodgers. Over under 4.5 of those 6 division winners win their divisions again this year.
I will say under. I think the Yankees are a clear-cut favorite in that division. Dodgers, clear-cut favorite in theirs. I have worries about the Houston Astros. Everybody in that division has gotten better. I like the Oakland Athletics. The American League Central, the Twins win. But Twins are the best team in that division. But it wouldn't surprise me if Cleveland or even the White Sox gave them a pretty good battle. The National League East is completely wide open. 4 of the 5 teams could win it, and it wouldn't surprise me. The NL Central is the same way, other than the Pirates. Any of those 4 teams could win. So, yeah, I definitely play the under there.
All right, what if it was 3.5? Still the under?
It depends on what the number would be, the juice. But I would, off the top of my head, I would say 3 would be the correct number. Yankees, Dodgers, and either the Astros or the Twins. Anything more than that would surprise me.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, you know, the East and the Central, the National League, as you mentioned, I mean, there's 4 teams in both of those divisions that could win it. I do think Philadelphia is the weakest of those 8 teams that have a chance. So I think maybe it's more of a 3-team race in the NL East for me. I'm not high on Philadelphia at all this season, and neither was Pecota, which we'll talk about here in a second. I'm just not a big believer in the Phillies. I like the Mets quite a bit, which is obviously terrifying given that, you know, they kind of find a way to screw things up every single year. But that NL Central is very wide open. I do like Cincinnati there in that one, and we'll talk about that more as we go forward here. But, yeah, I mean, you know, outside of the Dodgers, and I think the Rays could kind of chase down the Yankees. I think they could make that one very, very close. But to me, the Dodgers are easily the clear-cut, you know, best team in baseball, especially with Mookie Betts. Now, they'd be the only lock, I would say, for a division. I'd be surprised if Houston lost. I think they're a year away from really kind of collapsing a little bit. But again, this is why I don't think there's a whole lot of value, you know, in these division futures because, okay, you know, let's say that you think that, you know, maybe the Mets or Washington can win the East over the Braves. Well, what are you getting in that return? You know, plus 125, plus 175, plus 200, something like that to tie your money up for 6 months. Right. There's just not a lot of equity in division futures at all in baseball.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And it's something, the tying your money up is the major part to me because there's plenty of times, you know, I play a lot of season wins. I play a lot of game of the year type of things. And I know, especially with the games of the year, that I'm going to have an advantage at the end of the year by playing, you know, the Red Sox to win the American League East at this point. I could get probably better numbers later in the season. The Red Sox personnel isn't strong enough for me to think they're going to beat the Yankees. And Tampa's a team that is just a better organization. So that's one of the things you got to take a look at the organizations. And there's certain teams that, you know, say what you will about the Indians. The Indians are always competitive, and they've cut the payroll. Anytime you cut the payroll, it's not a good thing when you're playing overs for season wins. But they have found ways around it. The Twins, for years, are one of those teams that you take a look at the personnel and you think, how does this team win? They're just good teams. And San Diego's maybe just the opposite, where you've got great prospects. You've got a place where it's a nice ballpark. Everybody wants to play in San Diego, beautiful city, but they always seem to underperform. And you see it each and every year. And, you know, well, last couple of years, they've gone out and brought in some major free agents, and they still can't win.
Well, and I think it's a good segue into taking a look at the Pecota projections that came out yesterday, because everybody's kind of talking about this. And, you know, it's one of those things that, look, I mean, I don't love projection systems, and there are a lot of them out there, as we know. I'm just not really a huge fan of them. And keep in mind, too, that Pecota's not looking to predict an exact win-loss record. It's taking a range of expected outcomes, and then the average is what they put out there for Pecota. But it is something that can have something of an impact, you know, on the season win total market. It is something that people do take an extended look at. It's not something that I necessarily love. But you take a look at a team here like the St. Louis Cardinals. You know, the St. Louis Cardinals are a team that year in and year out, they perform close to expectation. They end up falling very, very close to their season win total number. It just, for whatever reason, it's the way that things kind of play out for them. This year, their Pecota projection is about 80 wins, and their season win total out there right now in the 87.5 range. Last year, they won 91 games. There are some organizations that just perform well year in and year out. I wouldn't say they underachieve. They don't overachieve. They perform to expectation. And now you get something with Pecota where the Cardinals expected to really fall off here. And I'm not going to say it makes you question the formula, makes you question the system, but it is one of those things that kind of makes you think a little bit.
Yeah, anybody who puts these things out early and stands by them, I give them all the credit in the world. Doesn't mean they have to be right. It just means that they're going out and telling you that. And if I agree with the Cardinals, I think the 80.3, I believe they have it at, is a little low, because the Cardinals got some really good minor leaguers that may make a difference this year. If you could correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Pecota, wasn't that the one with the Cubs last year, said they were going to win about 80 games?
Yes. Yeah, and that caused a massive ripple. I mean, the Cubs organization was pissed. Everyone was out there talking about it on social media. And, I mean, hey, you know what? The Cubs are interesting, too, because the last week of the year, they were horrible. I think they were 2-10 over their last 12 games, something like that. They were right there in the playoff hunt and then just totally fell apart. And it looks like they did have this dramatic fall off closer to where Pecota projected them. But a lot of that was just because they played badly in the last week of the year.
Yeah, I had the Cubs under, and that was one of my bigger bets for season wins last year. So I agree with the Pecota. People take a look at stars, and we kind of touched on this last week. You know, we talked about the White Sox, some of the players that they brought in, and some of the other teams brought in these big stars. People tend to basically overrate the stars or what these guys have done before. And keep in mind, it's a totally different situation. Every team, you know, you got different hitting coaches, different pitching coaches. Just because you bring in a guy that's done well in the past at a certain place doesn't mean he's going to do nearly as well at the next place. And that was like Philadelphia last year. Philadelphia brought in all this high-priced talent, you know, and they underperformed. And that was, I bet them under. It worked out well for me. But, yeah, it's a different game. You really need to look at who they had, how many at-bats they had, what will they do now. It's like, you know, for the Indians, it looks like their entire outfield at least for the most part, five of their six guys or whatever are going to be guys who are playing against lefties or playing against righties. So instead of looking at what they've done completely, you have to look and say, okay, well, Bauer, this guy's going to hit against lefties. This guy's going to hit against righties. What will their combined output be when you compare that to somebody else who may have a full-time guy who is there? So even they're using everybody on the bench. And for Terry Francona, that's what he has done since he's been to Cleveland. You're not going to get your guys with 700 at bats unless you're Lindor, as opposed to other teams who run out the same players each and every day. The Dodgers have been very good at that. The Dodgers will rest some of their players because they're so deep. And I prefer teams like that because if there is an injury, they can bounce back from it a little bit better than a team who comes into the season thinking, okay, this is our nine guys, and they don't have, you know, the guys on the bench to make the big difference. And, you know, as we've seen with the Yankees already and the pitching staff, losing a guy early like that can really make a difference.
All right, so we transition over to a very different market here for a couple of minutes to finish up this segment with Brian Leonard, and that's the NBA. And Brian, we've got 11 games tonight here. There are no back-to-backs for Thursday, so all 22 of these teams playing their final games before the All-Star break tonight. Does that change the way you handicap these games this evening?
Yeah, it's definitely a concern. I always try to put myself in the position of the players. Will they be excited to go on vacation? Are they looking past this game? We talked about something that I noticed with Cleveland the other day when they went to Oklahoma City, and they looked terrible the game before. Then they go to Oklahoma City, a game that they're not supposed to win, and they're in it the entire game. Now they're at home against an Atlanta team, catching 2 points. Will Cleveland try to get the victory? Obviously they want to look good, but I still think they're tanking. Whereas Atlanta, they've gone out and they picked up a center. Atlanta's a team that, you know, they may not make the playoffs this year, but I think they're still trying to win. And with the new additions, each team has a new addition at center, but I think it's more important for Atlanta to get the victory. And so if I'm looking at that game based on what I've seen so far, I'd lean with Atlanta. But there's certain teams that, you know, at this point, the season's been a disaster for them. And they get a chance to go out and, get on vacation. They've already made their plans. Are they really going to show up for this game? There's a few teams out there that are in that boat. But there's other teams that have the veteran leaders. The Lakers, a team with veteran leadership, playing on the road to Denver, a team that they'll likely play in the playoffs. It wouldn't surprise me if they come out and play their normal game tonight when they play in the Denver Nuggets.
Yeah, that's a big question about Cleveland tonight. Also, the weather is going to be awful in Cleveland. So, I mean, they don't draw anyway right now, but they're not going to have very much of a crowd at all whatsoever here in tonight's game. And like you said, you know, it was a great point you made last week that, you know, when they play teams they can beat or at the very least compete with, they don't show up. When they play teams better than them where they know they're going to lose anyway, then they wind up showing up and covering some big numbers. So maybe a Cleveland fade in the cards here for tonight. But with the NBA going dark here, I noticed that the NHL schedule is really condensed. They don't have to fight for the arena dates. So a lot of NHL games here over the next week or so. But, you know, now that the NBA is going to go on break, people won't be able to bet it. Maybe they're going to try to find something to do with that money burning a hole in their pockets. May go over to the college basketball side here. And it's kind of a buyer beware thing right now if you haven't been paying attention to college basketball.
Yeah, college basketball. I'll be honest with you, I had Michigan State yesterday, and they're up by 20 in the second half. And the people I was with said, that's a winner. And I says, I've been there enough where I know that nothing's over. And sure enough, even the worst part was they won, but they failed to cover. And that's just the way it is. College teams, young players get out certain runs. The Mississippi game yesterday, they're out being outscored by like 12 early on in the game. They win the game by 25. In what was basically a pickup situation. So a lot of variance in college basketball, and it's just something you got to be aware of. I would encourage, to be honest with you, if people don't play a lot of hockey, start looking at hockey because, you know, a lot of people like to play underdogs. And I think hockey gives you a lot of advantage of playing underdogs just based on the way the puck bounces. And, you know, just because you're the better team that day does not mean you get the victory. And to me, if you're an underdog player, and I am in baseball, the only other sport that I think has that kind of value is the NHL. And you look at the records of these teams, they're all relatively close. There's, you know, it's sort of like baseball when you've got a few teams that are just dominant and you've got, you know, one or two teams that are bad, but everybody else on a given night can win and you're getting, you know, real good plus money in a lot of these cases.
Brian Leonard, professional handicapper over at WagerTalk.com. What's going on over there right now, man?
A little bit different day today over at Wager Talk. We're doing a lot of videos, what we call evergreen videos, where we talk about going with each handicapper, giving our top things we look for in each sport. So a little bit different than breaking down the games, because obviously we've got the NBA going on a break and it's so tough to handicap, you know, a few days in advance of the games. So we've decided to do that this week, and it'll be interesting to see. They're going to go through each handicapper and each of them give them 2 or 3 points. So I'm looking to hear what the other guys look at in certain sports and how to handicap certain teams, how to make a living doing this. So it'll be interesting on videos. I would recommend people to take a look at the videos we start putting out today.
Well, of course, as always, make sure you follow Brian on Twitter at @BLeonardSports. Brian Leonard, professional handicapper over at WagerTalk.com. Appreciate your time as always, man. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds great. Best of luck to everyone.
There you go. There's Brian Leonard. Once again, you can find his work over at WagerTalk.com and follow him on Twitter at @BLeonardSports. We got one more guest, one more segment here for this Wednesday edition of the program. That is Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds on the number one on Twitter. Regular contributor to VSiN and the Point Spread Weekly newsletter. Wes, how's it going today, man?
Going well, Adam. How about yourself, sir?
Doing very well, buddy. Appreciate your time as always here, sir. And you know what? I've told our listeners that we're going to do this. And we're going to do this every Wednesday on our segments with Wes here, at least through the national championship game. That is talk some XFL. We've got week 2 here coming up. But obviously, before we get to week 2, we got to take a look back at what happened in week 1. And Wes, I think the biggest story from week 1 is that a lot of these totals got whacked up in the betting market and the games were lower scoring than we expected.
Yeah, they did. In terms of the openers, which were done at Circa Sports, they kind of functioned, I guess, as the ex officio guinea pig in terms of making these numbers. And to be fair, you didn't really have much to go on, being that there were no preseason games. There were a couple of controlled scrimmages that the teams did in Houston a few weeks ago, but no real data to go on. So what ended up happening is you had 2 of the 4 games, both the Saturday games, went over the opening total and then went under what ended up being the closing total. So closing totals went 3-1 to the under. And I think it's a combination of a couple things. The league wants more scoring because of the rules that they have. It is always a running clock, but it is a 25-second play clock. So you're not bleeding a lot of clock necessarily in between plays. The ball is spotted usually pretty quickly. There's certain smaller nuances in the rules in terms of you only need 1 foot in bounds for a catch, just like the college rule. You also have what is called in the final 2 minutes of each half, they call it the comeback period, where play stops after each play is completed. Almost like if it's a first down in college football, but it really doesn't matter. Even if you lose yards, they stop the clock to spot the ball. And then once the ball is spotted, then the clock can proceed. So the clock stops pretty much after every play in the final 2 minutes. So they want that. That's a way, I think, to potentially manufacture scoring. They do not have extra point kicks either. They have where you can go for the conversion after the touchdown, but they do it on basis of where you go from the yard line. So a traditional 1 point extra point would be running an offensive play from the 2 yard line. If you want to go from 2, it's the 5 yard line. And if you want to go for a 3 point play, you do it from the 10 yard line. So that's a way maybe to add some scoring. And also in terms of, of just a couple different things in the fact that the field position they want to make better, because what they do with the kickoffs is they basically line the kick gunner unit, what would be, it's not really gunners in this spot because they're stationary, and the kick return unit, and they let the kicker kick the ball, and the only people that can move necessarily until the receiver, the return man, catches the ball are the kicker and the return man. And then once the ball has been received by the return man, then you can go forward to your setting up a return or busting the wedge, whatever term you want to call it. And that's how they do it, I think, for kick returns, because they don't want these touchbacks necessarily. They want kick returns to be a part of the game. So that's what they're trying to do. I think eventually the scoring's going to go up and it'll get better as these guys get more used to the rules and whatnot, but also as the teams get used to each other, because these are brand new teams. This is not like an average NFL roster where even if you have a high amount of turnover on a 53-man roster, you've still got high 30s, low 40s in terms of players coming back. So there's some cohesion. So they know each other a little bit and have played together longer. And this is a brand new spot for these teams. And plus, to put your offensive systems into play, it takes a little bit of time just with the timing issue in terms of receivers and quarterbacks getting their timing out, offensive line getting their protections down. So I do think the scoring is going to exponentially increase, but that might have been something that the market didn't consider and just taking numbers and then the piggybackers come in and follow suit. That might have been something they didn't take into consideration.
Yeah, and it certainly felt like, you know, there is kind of that feeling out process, you know, whether it's just on a team level or on a league level overall. At Adam Chernoff on Twitter, Adam Chernoff is one of the most brilliant people in this space. Very much respect his work. He ran some of the numbers here, took a look. 124 plays per game in week one. The expectation was that this would be faster than the NFL in terms of plays per game. That wasn't necessarily the case. Just under 5 yards per play, 4.98. But as you go through and look at the box scores here over at XFL.com, the Seattle Dragons, 21 of 41 passing. The Defenders, the DC Defenders with Cardale Jones, 16 of 26. And that 62% was actually one of the better completion percentages on a team level league-wide here. You had some teams that were under 50%, like the Tampa Bay Vipers. Matt McGloin for the DC Guardians was 52%. Really, Philip Nelson and Jordan Te'amu in the St. Louis and Dallas game, the two best sets of quarterback numbers, there were only 24 points scored in that game. So obviously some timing mechanism issues with the quarterbacks and the wide receivers. And again, that feeling out process. And, you know, we see that in a lot of other sports too, where as the games increase in importance, there's kind of that feeling out process. Things kind of slow down a little bit. For a lot of these guys, this is their first big shot, and the game's kind of played out that way in a little bit of a tentative manner. So, you know, we could see things improve here in week two, but certainly as we get to weeks three, four, five, and so on.
Yeah, and I think it may not be immediate. In terms of the numbers that they put up for the totals this week, they put them up higher simply because, look, when you put it at 40.5, and even though three ended up going under the closing number, obviously 40.5 was too low, but the closing numbers last week where they got bet up ended up being too high. So, you know, you see a lot of the totals this week in the high 40s is probably where they should be. There's one that's over 50, that being the Houston Roughnecks, who ended up scoring, I think, 37 points last week. Philip Walker, P.J. Walker, the former Indianapolis Colt out of Temple, threw four touchdowns, and that's a June Jones coach team, so it's more of a run-and-shoot type of offense. And they were really, I think, the only offense that kind of seemingly fired on all cylinders in week one, hence they have the highest total at 50.5.
Yeah, and as we look too, I mean, let's keep in mind, you know, Landry Jones didn't play, Josh Johnson didn't play. Obviously, those are the two most accomplished quarterbacks here in this league. We do have guys like Cardale Jones, Matt McGloin, that, you know, Jones obviously had that 1 year at Ohio State. McGloin's been a backup and, of course, played pretty well at Penn State as well. But, you know, we had some quarterback questions, and that was something I think was really difficult last week. We saw a lot of line moves, obviously, in this high variance environment, but injury information was very, very difficult to come by. Hopefully that gets streamlined a little bit more here going forward.
Yeah, I hope so as well, because you did have two quarterbacks that were supposed to be starters, Josh Johnson in L.A., Landry Jones in Dallas. We knew a little bit about the Jones injury. I did not actually know that Johnson wasn't going to play, and it was the backup, and then the game kind of got away from the L.A. team in the second half. So, yeah, I mean, finding information, it's going to take a little bit of work, at least early on, to kind of find this injury information, because we don't really yet know a lot about it. I mean, if you're looking at something like a Don Best screen, there's nothing really up for injury information. So I'm sure that's going to come out, I guess, later in the week.
So something that's really interesting here, as we start looking at some of the games and the spreads and the totals for these here this week, game 409-410, the New York Guardians take on the DC Defenders. Defenders 6.5-point favorite once again, which I believe is about the range where their line opened last week. Total here, though, is 48. This one is up, obviously, from last week. But you've got New York, who, correct me if I'm wrong, they played on Sunday last week, whereas DC played on Saturday. So we've got our first short week game here, obviously playing Saturday and Sunday throughout the course of the season. Our first short week game, and you've got to think with the newness and the infancy of this league, that could be to the detriment of New York here this week.
Yeah, and I think it's been bad accordingly, because I think the initial opener, and I keep in mind the initial opener, this is very early in the week. I think at Circa Sports, I believe that they had put out the Defenders -2. This was as of the afternoon of February 9th. And now you're seeing the Defenders as high as -7. So this was put out on Sunday. When games were still being played, or just in the immediate aftermath, right after the completion of the games. So, look, the Guardians were a team that I actually wanted to fade a little bit this week, because they got a 20-3 win over Tampa Bay, but they ended up getting outgained by, like, close to 150 yards. They just basically played fundamental football and kind of let Tampa Bay turn the ball over to them, which they did, and were able to take advantage of it. But now that this line is going up, and if it goes up a little bit more, I might be interested in not fading New York and actually taking New York, because DC, I think the folks have really kind of jumped on that train. If you watched that game last week, they probably had the best atmosphere. You know, people kind of really like this team, of course, because of Cardale Jones, and they're familiar with him from Ohio State. So, they were kind of all about this DC team. But the one thing about this league, I think, Adam, is it's going to be even maybe more conducive to live betting, because of the fact, like I explained earlier, with all these conversions that you could go for various point increments, there's no real true key numbers, at least at this point, like we see in terms of the NFL or in terms of even perhaps college football, where you're going to get some oddball scores here. I mean, we were watching that Tampa Bay New York game last week, and it's 20-3. And we were mentioning, you know, theoretically, this is still a 2-score game, even though you're down 17 points, because you can get a touchdown and go for a 3-point conversion. So, as absurd as that sounded, it was actually mathematically true. And then I think of that, because of these different conversions that you could go for, and these different type of scores you're going to get, the algorithms are completely different in terms of not having necessarily those key numbers that you would have in the other leagues.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. And again, I mean, you know, there's such a feeling out process here just in general with this league. And again, with the scoring format, and you know what that means, of course, to, you know, what's going to fall as a key number, you know, maybe when live betting starts to really kind of take hold with this. And they are embracing betting, so kudos to them for that. But, you know, the Guardians, like you said, I mean, it makes sense to see this line go up, you know, from -2 to as high as -7, because how often do you see a team win a game by 20 and have one third down conversion in 10 attempts. So, you know, it does seem like there's probably some regression to the mean coming here for the Guardians, as crazy as that sounds, since we don't really have a mean yet with any of these teams here in this league. But, you know, again, like you said, I mean, a team that gets outgained that badly, probably sort of expect them to kind of come back to earth a little bit.
Yeah, you absolutely would. So I think if you want to take the Guardians, maybe wait in terms of an in-game price and see if the defenders jump out early. I hate necessarily laying it with the defenders because it's already moved. Whether it was a good opener or not, it's already moved 5 points. So, yeah, I mean, I would be waiting maybe to take the Guardians in game in the spot.
All right, so the other game on Saturday here, the Tampa Bay Vipers take on the Seattle Dragons. Vipers a 3-point favorite in this one. Total of 45. It's the lowest total on the board here for this week's set of games. The Dragons return home after losing to the Defenders. The Vipers thought to be a very good team, thought to, you know, maybe have a little bit of a leg up on some of these teams here, you know, in particular with, you know, Mark Trestman and some of the skill position guys that they had. They gained almost 400 yards, but only scored 3 points. Now they make that long trip here up to Seattle. And again, this one on a short week with that Sunday to Saturday turnaround.
Yeah, two teams with some quarterback questions here. On the Tampa Bay side, Aaron Murray did not play well. He forced a lot of bad throws when they were in scoring position, got a couple picked off, and really left a lot of points on the board. Tampa Bay also, they ended up using two quarterbacks, kind of platooned them a little bit back and forth in the second half. Tampa Bay has quarterback slash running back, and that's how he's listed on the roster, Quentin Flowers, who is the all-time leading passer at South Florida. So we shall see if maybe eventually he takes over. But Aaron Murray was not good in that game on Sunday. And look, I thought Tampa Bay was going to be a better team because Mark Trestman has a lot of coaching experience in a wide variety of areas. Especially, he was especially good in the CFL, winning 3 Grey Cups. So this is a guy, but then we kind of saw Chicago Bears' Mark Trestman, I guess, last week. Moved the ball, couldn't put any points on the board. On the Seattle side, at the end of the game against the Defenders, and that was the opening game of the weekend last weekend in D.C., Brendan Silvers out of Troy hurt his ankle, excuse me, late in the game. And not sure really, I've got to check that injury status because they may go with the backup, who is B.J. Daniels, also out of South Florida, if Brendan Silvers can go. Two teams that didn't look very good, 0-1. So look, I guess one of them has got to win. I was a little bit higher on the Vipers than I was on Seattle to start the season, so I would lead with them in the spot.
Yeah, it's such an interesting one too, especially because, you know, you sort of wonder here as we get a look at some of these players, you know, how much do they improve and how quickly do they improve? Because, you know, Aaron Murray, look, 231 yards on only 16 completions, but the problem is only 16 completions, the 2 picks, got sacked 3 times. And you know, Tampa Bay, it just, maybe Trestman's offense is a little bit too complicated early on in this process for them. Because again, these teams had what, you know, the one set of scrimmages and then a handful of practices. And
yeah,
they put up some yards, they put up some big plays, but also the 5 sacks allowed. And you know, how much of that changes from one week to the next, where maybe Trestman is taking this a little bit too far in terms of the complication of the playbook. Flowers, of course, did run around a little bit. That's another thing here too. You know, everyone's trying to figure out their base defenses. If Flowers gets to play some more and he had 5 carries for 34 yards, maybe there's more improvisation to where there are some more big plays for the Vipers. Again, early on here in this process, I know people want to try and take advantage of what looks like a higher variance environment, but I mean, this is going to be tough at the outset for sure.
Yeah, I absolutely think that it is. And even though I'm doing some work on this stuff, I ended up not having a play the first weekend because I wanted to kind of see this before I really jumped in. I think obviously starting this week and then as you go along, there's more opportunities to kind of jump in and maybe a little bit more certainty in terms of what we're going to see.
All right, so we look at the next game here. This is the first one on Sunday between the Dallas Renegades and the Los Angeles Wildcats. Dallas, a four-point road favorite in this one. Total of 48. And, you know, this Dallas team probably thought to be the best team in the league in a lot of people's minds. They didn't really show it there in week one, losing to the Battlehawks.
And maybe they still end up being, but, I mean, I thought the main reason that they were the favorite, to be honest with you, going into the season, at least in terms of the futures market, is mainly because of the familiarity with Bob Stoops and Landry Jones. He's arguably the most high-profile coach of the eight in the XFL. So I thought, okay, that's why they really like this team. And it ended up that they ended up not scoring an offensive touchdown. It's probably the ugliest game, really, of the four. So check on the injuries. Wait to see who's going to take over. If it's not going to be Philip Nelson, if Landry Jones is ready to go, he's going to be the one to go. They also have Eric Dungy, who people might remember from playing at Syracuse. So that's on the Dallas side. In the L.A. side, trying to see if Josh Johnson will be back. I thought Charles Knopf played okay at times for L.A., but certainly, I mean, wasn't great, wasn't awful. But I don't know really what to do in terms of a bet for this game. The lean would be to L.A. here, because I want to see the quarterbacks. And plus, L.A., actually, they were so bad, I guess, on defense that they let go of Pepper Johnson the day after the game, after the first week, as their defensive coordinator. So, you know, the one tricky thing about this game is you're definitely going to have to look for the injury updates. Certainly not as easy necessarily to find information as it would be for the NFL.
Yeah, the injury situation is definitely going to play a huge role in this game. Obviously, you know, the biggest role of any game here this week, because you do have a scenario in which both quarterbacks could be out. But I will say this, you know, a lot of people, I think the common thought process here, and we'll talk about the Battle Hawks a little bit more in a couple of minutes, was that St. Louis was probably the worst of the eight teams here in this league in a lot of people's minds. Say what you will about Dallas's offense and, of course, you know, not having Landry Jones, but their defense also gave up 374 yards in that game, 5.3 yards per play. They had a hard time getting off the field. That seems almost as worrisome to me as not having Jones.
Yeah. And St. Louis was, I think, put low. If you look at who the coach is, Jonathan Hayes, former NFL tight end. This was a guy that was essentially the tight ends coach for Marvin Lewis in Cincinnati for the Bengals for most of Marvin Lewis's run. But then when I looked at Jonathan Hayes, I was like, well, what, he never really got a shot as a coordinator or an assistant head coach someplace. So I thought maybe that was a little telling, and I think that's probably why the market believed them to be the lowest rated of the teams. And then the quarterback is Jordan Tamu from Ole Miss, who, look, he never really lit it up at Ole Miss either. I mean, they had some a lot of inconsistencies on offense. Maybe there were some coaching issues, but this isn't a guy that actually set the world on fire in the SEC. So yeah, for this St. Louis game, maybe would be looking at going to the under, quite frankly, because this is the only total over 50. And I think it's because Houston scored 37 in that first week. So I'm not one that's going to be inclined to, like, bet the overs just immediately in week two. Eventually, I think there's going to be the adjustments where they get the market in the right place, and you probably get these totals in the mid-40s, and then you'll see them go over as more teams get accustomed to the rules and obviously their offensive systems and schemes that they're running. So if I were to play this game, I can't get there with the Battle Hawks as an underdog. And then I think Houston could be, that's recency bias, where they could be a little bit overpriced in a league that I still think to this point has a lot of parity. I don't think you want to make too many snap judgments in week one. So I don't think that there's that much of a discrepancy, at least through 1 week, that you can say there's a lot of discrepancy there, a lot of difference between 1 through 8. I don't think that there exists that to this point. So if I'm going with the bet in that St. Louis Houston game, I'd go to the under 50.5.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be really interesting, too, to see a little bit more from this Houston defense because, you know, I mean, they only allowed 3.9 yards per play in that game last week to the Wildcats, and they were nursing a decent lead for the most part, too. I mean, Nelson Spruce was really the only guy that did anything against them with 11 grabs for 103 yards. What is St. Louis able to do here? Because the thing about St. Louis, because of Te'amu and because of his legs, they were probably the most balanced offensive team in the league last week. A high completion percentage, a high efficiency offensive output for them running the ball and throwing the ball. Now you kind of wonder if they're able to follow that through here this week and also see, you know, what sorts of adjustments all of these teams make. So again, early on in the process, I know it's football. I know we all want to get excited about it, but again, there will be some of that give and take. There will be a lot of adjustments made, obviously. And I think we just need to get some more data points before we really dive in.
Yeah, I do too. This is still very early, so it's a highly speculative market at this point.
All right, so just in the interest of time here, I want to make sure we get enough time to talk about the Genesis Invitational. So we'll talk some more Big Ten basketball with you next week, and also I kind of don't mind not talking about what happened with Michigan State last night since I was on the Spartans. So instead of that, we'll talk about golf here. We'll talk about this Genesis Invitational, which used to be the Genesis Open, used to be the Los Angeles Open, and about 35 other different names, but now it's an invitational status tournament, which means smaller field, bigger purse, and really good field.
Yeah, 120 players this week at the Genesis Invitational, including 9 of the top 10 in the world, 30 of the 50 in terms of the official world golf rankings. And like you said, this has just gained invitational status. Tiger Woods is now going to be the ex officio tournament host. Tiger Woods Foundation is the organizer and the philanthropic organization that benefits and also puts on the event. If you remember, Tiger had that tournament. They had that tournament in D.C. called the National, or in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area. That has went away as the Quicken Loan sponsorship went to the event in Detroit, now called the Rocket Mortgage Classic. So, yeah, this is an invitational, which is very similar to a couple other events on tour, Bay Hill, the Arnold Palmer Invitational down in Orlando, Jack Nicklaus's Memorial Tournament, the Old Colonial that's now called the Charles Schwab Challenge, and also the RBC Heritage in Hilton Head. So what this basically means is if you win one of these invitational events, usually for a regular tour event, if you win, like Nick Taylor did last week at Pebble Beach, you get a 2-year exemption. Now you get a 3-year exemption here for winning this event. So really big field at the top. You got a WGC in Mexico next week, so that probably benefits this event because most of these players are going to be more apt to come over here and play in an event. And being that it's a traditional event that's been around for a long time, it's in Los Angeles. So yeah, very top heavy field this week.
So with that in mind here, I mean, obviously we've got a lot of course data for this event. And even though this is the first year of this thing as an invitational status, a lot of these guys do play this event annually anyway. They certainly like playing at Riviera. You know, being in the LA area is not a bad thing for a lot of these guys. So we've got a lot of data points for these players. With that in mind, what sorts of guys are you looking to take here this week?
Yeah, this usually you would think, because it's not a very long course, about 7,300 yards. It's more of a strategic course with a lot of dog legs, so you're going to get a fair amount of blind approach shots. So usually you would by default say, oh, this is a ball strikers type paradise. But in recent years, and I don't think you have to be one of these guys to win, but in recent years, you've seen bombers do very well here. Dustin Johnson, Bubba Watson has won 3 times here, 2014, 2016, and 2018. J.B. Holmes is a guy who can get it out there. He's won here. Phil Mickelson's won a couple times here. So, yeah, I mean, and in fact, you've seen a fair amount of left-handed players win here, ironically enough, largely because of Bubba and Phil. But greens and regulation are important really every week. They're also important here. These are not very big greens. They're Poa Anua. You have Kikuyu Fairways and Rough, which the only other course that you have on tour that has that combination is Torrey Pines in San Diego, where they played 3 weeks ago.
All right, so with that in mind, are you looking at bombers? Are you looking at putters? Are you looking at ball strikers? Who's on your list this week?
I went with a little bit of a mix here, and I didn't necessarily go with the top guys, of which you can make arguments for everybody. I ended up keeping Bubba Watson off, even though I think he's obviously a very good form guy here. I just thought the price was too low. I mean, you're seeing Bubba Watson at some places at 20-1, and it's like, when do you see Bubba Watson necessarily the same price as a Xander Schauffele? Or a Patrick Cantlay or somebody like that. So I thought that was a little bit of an overreaction. So I left him off and skirted him. It might be to my peril because he's won the last three even numbered years. So if he continues that pattern, this would be the year to do it. But I went with Patrick Cantlay. He was my shortest guy at 20-1. UCLA Bruin. So he's played this course a lot in terms of his college golf. He was fourth here a couple years ago. Went also with Tony Finau at 30-1. We know that Finau had that tournament in Scottsdale, won a couple weeks ago, and then Webb Simpson makes two birdies on the two last holes and ended up beating him in a playoff. So that's kind of the book on Finau. The tee to green profile and a lot of the metrics are there, but he just hasn't been able to close the deal. But he's actually priced shorter here at 30-1 instead of like 33 or 35 like he was in Phoenix a couple weeks ago. He's priced shorter in terms of, and it gets a much better field. So maybe the market's given us a tell there. I don't know. But I went with him. Mark Leishman at 50-1. This is a guy that's beaten the best field on tour this year at Torrey Pines 3 weeks ago. And he's still priced, I think, pretty high in the market in terms of being a 50-1 or so guy with a couple top fives here. He's somebody I liked. Colin Morikawa, and I played a couple more young guys here than I usually would because usually they're veterans that win this type of event and course experience matters. But I went with Morikawa at 55-1. Just the ball striking is really good. He's an LA native, so he's an LA kid. And him and another guy, I bet, Joaquin Niemann, they don't necessarily have experience in terms of the Genesis Invitational, the event, but they both played here back at the U.S. Amateur in 2017, and both of them were in the top 10 in the stroke play event, where they now do a stroke play, and then they seed you in kind of that knockout match play bracket thing for the U.S. Amateur. So they've both played here before. Cameron Champs, a little bit of a bomb at 125, a guy that really is a bomber. Ended up not finishing great last week because he ended up shooting 79 on Sunday, 7 over par at Pebble Beach. But the Pebble Beach got a lot of guys, including Dustin Johnson on Sunday, because the wind really started to pick up. So that's why you saw a lot of guys dip up and down the leaderboard.
Well, I definitely like that list. We mentioned Leishman on yesterday's show with Brian Blessing. That was one of the names that I threw out there. I know you like to play that local angle, too, with a guy like Morikawa, and, you know, especially because those are guys that have a lot of experience here with these courses, and you know, that's never a bad thing to consider here early on, especially during the California swing. Wes Reynolds, you can hear his work on VSiN. Also see him in the Point Spread Weekly newsletter and follow him on Twitter at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Wes, when are you going to be on this week?
All over the place, really, man. Just because some of the days have switched around a little bit as we've added some new programming. But we'll be on Friday night from 6 to 10 Pacific. And then over the weekend, you can go to VSiN.com and find the details of where you can find our XFL betcast, in which I will be on the early game in terms of both Saturday and Sunday. And then Monday, the usual slot, 6 to 10 p.m. Pacific time on the Green Zone with Brady Cannon. Our golf show is debuted now. It's going to be every Tuesday night, 5 Pacific, 8 Eastern on VSiN, called Long Shots, where we do an hour show and look at the scene around golf, mainly PGA Tour focus. But as we get more like LPGA or Champions Majors and maybe get some bigger European Tour events, we'll certainly discuss those. So all over the place, man.
Definitely looking forward to all of that. Once again, make sure you follow Wes on Twitter at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Wes, a pleasure as always, man. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll talk to you again next week.
You got it, Adam. Thanks for having me, as always.
There you go. There's Wes Reynolds. Once again, you can find him on VSiN and in that Point Spread Weekly newsletter at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. Coming up on our Thursday edition of Bang the Book Radio, I'm going to do the Bettors Box to start things off on Thursday's show. Then we'll chat some college basketball and some NBA with John Ryan, a professional handicapper who also writes for us over at bangthebook.com. Then Friday, we'll chat with Greg Peterson, and I'll give you some of my thoughts as we head on into the weekend in the NHL and college basketball. That'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.